He remains unconcerned. By this time, he's smoking. Eaves are thinner and longer than a regular cigarette, and sitting with his chin defiantly high, awaiting the next question. The inquiry continues, pointed but not aggressive, for 2 hours or so, until Lotta abruptly launches into a series of would-you-be-surprised-to-know questions, the first of which he backs up with statements from, quote, 5 or 6 different people, who have sworn that Rob was with Maurice, Mike, and Forrest not just for a few hours, as he'd claimed, but for the entire night. Would Rob find that to be a surprise? Springsteen says yes, a complete and total surprise. But it's the next question that gets him. Would you be surprised, Lotta asks, if I told you that the Rocky Horror Show wasn't even showing at North Cross on Friday, December 6th, 1991? The effect of this is not reflected in the written transcript. To understand the damage, you have to watch the tape. Of course, Lotta didn't exactly say the movie hadn't played that night, but the inference hits home. Rob's head pops up, and his voice tightens as, clearly, the worm of doubt begins to uncurl. And within the next quarter of an hour, Lotta tells Rob it's no coincidence they came to West Virginia after all these years. It's because of a new technology called DNA that's tremendously important. And Rob gets it. The cops are talking science. They're saying they found his DNA at the scene, aren't they? At about this same time, the Charleston cop Eric Hodges is refusing to allow Brett Thompson into the station to talk to his stepson, even after Thompson says he doesn't think Rob's capable of making a legal decision on his own. Hodges assures him that Rob has been afforded his full rights and issued a Miranda statement, which he has waived. But Thompson's not convinced and suspects Hodges doesn't really know what the Austin cops are up to, or if what he just said is true. Perhaps Rob's stepfather sniffs this out, because he goes home and calls Dave Bungert, a local attorney whose offices are directly across the street from the police station. Bungert strolls over, and right at the moment when Rob's starting to crack, he's in the reception area, telling Hodges that he's been hired by Robert Springsteen's family to represent him, and would like for the interrogation of his client to come to an immediate halt. Hodges tries soothing him with the same lies he told to Thompson, adding what the Austin detectives had instructed him to, that because a third party had arranged for the lawyer, not the suspect himself, they don't have to let him talk to Robert. Bungert gives Hodges his business card and leaves. The Charleston Police Department will close for the day at 4:30. Lights off, doors locked, one officer to stand patrol, everybody else gone. Half an hour later, Eric Hodges drives to the mall for dinner. Anyone hoping to enter the CPD offices is out of luck until he returns. But in the interrogation room, the lights burn on. The Nagra tape has run out. The APD is nailing Rob Springsteen to the wall. Pretty much all of us maintain belief in a sense of self that defines us and what we think we might or might not be capable of. Many friends of the four men arrested for the ICBY murders refused to believe they were involved. "He's not that kind of guy," they'd say. At his home in West Virginia in 2010, Springsteen characterized himself to me as a normal guy who would never do anything like kill somebody, because that's not me. As for prosecutors, cops, and Austinites, they don't know anything about me. Like a psychiatrist, the interrogator has to figure out how to break through the armor of a suspect's self-characterization and drive him to the point of thinking he isn't who he'd always thought, dreamed, or hoped he was, that he is, or may be, somebody else altogether, a stranger to himself, perhaps even a killer. At about 5 o'clock, just after he plants the seed of doubt in Rob's mind about the Rocky show, Lara pulls this off. He's still hammering at Rob's timeline, employing a repetitive, "What happened next?" series of questions, focusing on the crucial hours from 10 until midnight. "Okay," he says after Rob describes driving around in Maurice's car on what he thinks was that night, although he can't be sure. It might have been the weekend before or the one after. They were always driving around in Maurice's car. "What happened then?" Rob says he thinks they went to the movie, though given what Lara told him, he guesses they didn't. And if they didn't go to the Rocky show, he doesn't know what they did. "Or anyway," he says, "I don't remember." But he does know one thing. "I was never in that yogurt shop, never." Lara ignores that, presses on. "And so now Rob's sure there wasn't a movie? Now that I've told you?" Rob says no, he's not sure of that. He said he doesn't remember, one way or the other, but he wants the detectives, you guys, to believe him. I believe that to be the truth. "So what then? Do you remember seeing the movie?" "Not that night, precisely. Maybe I did and maybe I didn't." So what Rob told Lara was a white lie, wasn't it? Because he wasn't really there. "We know that," Lara declares. Can he at least admit he wasn't there? "Well," Rob says, "we were definitely outside the movie." "Okay. But outside's a whole lot different than inside, right?" "Maybe we didn't go in," Rob concedes. Lara takes on the tone of a disappointed father. "Rob," he says, "Rob." But when he continues to insist he doesn't remember, the detective becomes streetwise. "I wasn't born yesterday, brother." "Does Springsteen get that?" "Yes." "Okay, you weren't actually in the movies as you told us earlier." Springsteen says no. "Got him." Lara pushes for specifics. "Was he inside or outside in the parking lot? Or somewhere else? What exactly was he doing? Isn't it reasonable to think he was next to the theater but not inside it?" Rob agrees that's a very reasonable thing to say. He doesn't really remember being outside, but it's probably reasonable to think he was. At this point, the overconfident Rob might have convinced himself he was asserting his proficiency as a gamer and quite adept at engaging in hypotheticals, that he has a chance to outsmart this wise guy Latino by seconding the reasonableness of a statement without specifically acknowledging the truth of it. Lara knots the two strands of conjecture into one. Okay, so he's down with Rob's suggestion of a reasonable possibility. Is Rob comfortable with it? Although Rob hadn't said reasonable possibility, he says he'll go with it. No, Lara says, he can't just go with it. Is he comfortable with it? Springsteen says, yes, he is. Is it the truth? It's possible. It's possible, Lara says, echoing him. Anything's possible, right? Rob's into the wordplay. Well, he says, yes. But Lara's not. Is it possible, he asks calmly and without obvious ill intent, you killed those girls? After all, Lara reminds him, that's what he said, that anything's possible. Rob guesses it's possible. After another couple of minutes, Lara rolls from possibilities to likelihoods, and the logical reason why the others involved in the murders, Maurice, Mike, and Forrest, have all included him in the picture. And in no time, Rob's powers of strategic banter fail him. Possible is possible, and what was once flatly denied begins to yield to the realm of imagination, of endlessly evolving conjecture. The gamer has crashed belly up in a real-world match. What we have, then, are two confessions obtained by some of the same interrogators relating to the same crime, and yet in each case the result of a different process, strategy, and breakdown. When Mike Scott was asked to stand on a chair and picture himself at the crime scene, he began to do exactly that, to envision the scene below with himself in it. Then, with a little help, he seems to have created a memory of an event that might or might not have occurred, what neuroscientists call a false or illusory memory. Like Sean Buddha Smith, who said while under Polanco's spell that he actually saw the blood and the raping. In false confession terms, Mike Scott internalized his custodian's suggestions until they turned into what seemed like memories. Rob, on the other hand, appears to have tricked himself into playing what he thought was an intellectual match against the big guys, without understanding the enormity of the mistake he'd made about the game itself, which had no rules other than those prescribed by Reed, where possibilities morph into certainties and cops make incriminating statements they assign to the suspect. That they were the smart ones never occurred to him. The edges of what Robert Springsteen IV considers his self, a normal guy doing normal things, begin to blur. He starts to think like the two men hammering at him, to imagine himself as he's being told he is. This is the turning point of many interrogations when the subject accepts the definition of himself that his persecutors have created and labeled authentic and unbiased. Imagination rules. Taking the blame becomes, weirdly, an escape. Rob accepts the detective's version of the night, describing what happened as a total clusterfuck. He gives details of the rapes, the murders, very little about the fire. He lays his head on his bent arm to recreate the position Amy Ayers was in when they left her. Prosecutors will describe his pose as a perfect replication of Amy's death posture, even though it isn't. The detectives are close to having what they came for. And then, just after 7 o'clock, Merrill makes what, from the police point of view, is an unfathomable mistake by issuing a precipitous Miranda warning. Rob comes too, as if from a swoon. Having seen the TV shows, he knows what happens next. They're not just talking. He's in custody. He refuses to sign. He needs to talk to his wife and to an attorney. He's not saying anything bad about the officers. He just needs to go home and clean up my mess. "There's the door," says the flustered, abashed Merrill. Springsteen hasn't implicated Mike Scott or the other two, and they barely touched on the fire. But if he won't sign the Miranda, they have to let him go. They even give him a ride. By 8 that night, some 12 hours after he finished restocking shelves at Kroger, Rob is at home with his family, having given the Austin cops a verbal statement describing his participation in the yogurt shop murders. Some of the details he provided match Scott's, but many do not. Some match the crime scene, yet again, many do not. In the years to come, Rob will recant. During his trial, when his attorney asks him to tell the jury why he confessed to something he didn't do, he says, "I guess I gave up on myself." He had assumed that once he got out of that room, he could take a lie detector test in West Virginia, not Texas, and that eventually forensic tests, fingerprints, DNA, blood, hair, whatever, would prove he hadn't been in the ICBY shop. There is, however, one thing he said that might be more important than he'd realized. In the final hour of his interrogation, Lotta had pushed him to admit what he did to 13-year-old Amy Ayers sexually. "Just admit it," he kept saying. "Say it, Rob, just say it." Eventually, Rob yielded. "Yes," he said. "Yes, okay, he did it." Lara demanded the words. "Okay," Rob said. "I put my dick in her pussy and I raped her." And, still wearing the ball cap low on his forehead, he looked up through those devilish eyebrows as if to say, "Is that enough?" Game over. Before being extradited to Texas, Rob will take a polygraph test in which he tests out as truthful when he says he didn't commit the murders and doesn't know who did. Although the results of the original rape kit test performed on Amy Ayers were negative, and even when more sophisticated DNA tests exclude Robert Springsteen IV from having left bodily fluid anywhere at the scene, the, quote, "dick in her pussy" statement will, according to his lead lawyer, seal his fate. Once the jury heard it, Jim Sawyer believes, his client was a dead man. Lotta, Neff, Merrill, and Meyer fly back to Austin. Merrill works for 3 days on a transcript of the interrogation, as all three of them struggle to recall words and phrases lost due to the clock camera's malfunction. Still not satisfied, Merrill sends the video and the Nagra tape to the Houston Crime Lab, and then to the BATF lab in Washington. Both work to enhance the videotape by merging sound from the Nagra into it, a kind of jerry-rigged voiceover they hope will create the semblance of an authentic recording. On the stand, Merrill will say that maybe 85% of the audio was accurate. There are also 8 or 9 minutes in the processed audio tape that don't appear on the video at all. But Springsteen said he did it, and he said he'd raped Amy Ayers. Next to that, everything else seemed pale and stingy. Arrests. Paul Johnson called in the task force. Though they had confessions, there were holes, contradictions, inconsistencies. Above all, they needed the weapons, and for Maurice to confess. A few days later, Johnson himself teamed up with APD cop Douglas Scolott and drove to Irving to interview Pierce in his lawyer's office. There, they told him he was about to be arrested, but if he confessed, he could at least prove he wasn't the ringleader, like the other guys said. But Pierce again denied any involvement in the murders, and the detectives came back empty-handed. Fuentes and Hardesty then drove to Lockhart to pick up Wellborn and transport him to APD headquarters, where Fuentes produced the first and last pages of Mike's statement. Rob had also confessed, he told Forrest. Both men had implicated him, and so had Maurice. Brilliant at keeping his mouth shut, Forrest also gave them nothing. So Scolott and Meyer drove him to the former site of the yogurt shop for a surprise meeting with Mike Scott, who walked straight up to Wellborn and said, "Hey, Forrest, remember me? I'm Mike Scott. I told the police everything," and suggested that he do the same. Clearly shocked, Forrest said he had no idea what the fuck Mike was talking about, or why he'd signed that statement, then turned away and just stood there gazing toward Shoal Creek. So Lotta and Hardesty took Mike home, and Scolott drove Forrest back to headquarters, where he conducted a wildly inept interrogation, going on far too long himself, describing the girls' screams, and telling him over and over again that he was there when they were killed, and even if he didn't kill any of them, he could have stopped what was going on, giving Forrest little time to offer anything other than the occasional, "I don't believe I was there." But he came too when the cop informed him that no matter what he said or didn't say, he was going to be arrested. That being the case, Forrest said he was ready to go home right now. "There's the goddamn door," Scolott told him. and Forrest left. The interview had lasted 25 minutes. A friend of mine who lived in Lockhart for a while used to take her car, a beater in constant need of repair, to Forrest Wellborn's shop. She said he was a sweet guy and often refused to charge her. In the second of three yogurt shop episodes on 48 Hours, aired in April 2000, after the arrests, Aaron Moriarty interviewed Forrest on the front porch of a small frame house he was hoping to buy. The floorboards of the porch sagged and skipped, the support beams leaned, the place seemed little more than a shack. Obviously, he couldn't afford to work for anybody for free, but my friend was nice to him, and he liked her, so he had. Like others, she couldn't imagine his being involved in any kind of violence. Some people, to this day, believe that Forrest Wellborn was seriously damaged by this case, ruining whatever shot he had at a better life. Knowing that photos of all four suspects would soon appear in local newspapers, the APD sent officers to interview some of the original eyewitnesses. Darrell Croft was shown three photo sheets with headshots of six young men, including Scott at 17, Springsteen at 15, and Pierce at 16. While most of the other pictures were in black and white, Maurice's was in color. Croft couldn't make an identification. When Lucilla Jones was shown the same photos, she too was unable to positively finger anybody. But when asked which one looked most like the young man she'd seen in the yogurt shop on December 6, 1991, she chose photo number 5, Maurice Pierce, on the first sheet. Not a bad response to take to the grand jury, although far less conclusive than what the APD and the DA's office were hoping for. There was also the matter of Maurice's eyes, which were a memorable icy blue. In the lineup photo, his eyes are dark and dull, and his photo has been cropped close to his face, leaving his hair color a mystery. A dark band around his forehead is presumably from a cap, but it might seem like his hair. When questioned on the witness stand, Lucilla Jones will say that for her, skin coloring was the best way to determine identity. During her original report in 1992, she thought that one boy might be Latino, but maybe not. Dark, at any rate. Out of respect, John Neff called John Jones before the story broke. Assuming that the arrests were the natural follow-up to the work he'd done, Jones congratulated him. Friday, October 1st, the Statesman's page one headline made it official. Arrests likely in yogurt shop killings. Police have suspects in 1991 deaths of four teens. No names were given, but it was reported that two of the four had confessed, that another had been questioned shortly after the murders, that none currently lived in Austin. According to a high-ranking law enforcement official who spoke to the paper on condition of anonymity, they hadn't made arrests before now because you don't want to solve just part of the case. We knew if we had arrested two of them right away, the other two would clam up. We have to bring all four to justice. As for the suspect who'd been questioned in 1991, that tip wasn't taken as far as it could have been. Jones's mood darkened. He couldn't help but take personally the implication that he'd somehow let Maurice Pierce off the hook. 4 days later, on October 5th, Paul Johnson wrote up separate affidavits in which he swore he had good reason to believe, and did believe, that each of these four men had committed the offense of felony and capital murder. He took the documents to 167th District Court Judge Mike Lynch, who read his brief descriptions of the suspect's involvement in the crimes and decided there indeed was sufficient probable cause to issue arrest warrants to Robert Burns Springsteen IV, Michael James Scott, Maurice Earl Pierce, and Forrest Brooke Wellborn on four counts of capital murder during the commission of a robbery. Under Texas law, prosecutors aren't required to offer bail to adults accused of a capital crime, so none was set for Springsteen and Scott. To ensure their legal rights, Lynch appointed attorneys to represent them. As for Pierce and Wellborn, because they were 16 and 15 at the time of the murders, their affidavits were delivered to 98th District Court Judge Jean Muirer, who specialized in juvenile and family law. She would appoint counsel as well as set bail and the starting date of a certification hearing to determine whether probable cause existed to justify waiving her jurisdiction in this juvenile case, thus sending these two into the adult system. The cert hearing would include witness testimony and arguments by both sides, at the end of which the judge herself would decide what would happen next. On Wednesday, October 6th, the four men were arrested in a coordinated sweep. Scott, just after he arrived at his storage space in South Austin, Springsteen at his home in Charleston, Pierce on his way to work, Wellborn at the auto repair shop. That afternoon, local television stations interrupted regular programming to show live footage of the four men being transported to jail. The coverage began, as usual, with the "Who Killed These Girls?" billboard. In a brief press conference, Ronnie Earl announced the arrests, and Chief Stan Nee praised the persistence of the investigators who had brought to justice four individuals for the brutal murder of four little girls. When his turn came, Mayor Kirk Watson appealed to a familiar sentiment. On December 6, 1991, he said, "We as a city lost our innocence. Today we regain our confidence." This prompted Jim Sawyer to call him later that day. "What happened," Sawyer asked, "to innocent until proven guilty?" All of them handcuffed and shackled. Scott was taken to the Travis County Jail, Springsteen to the South Central Regional Detention Center just outside Charleston, Wellborn and Pierce to the Gardner Betts Juvenile Detention Center. The names of the two younger defendants weren't released, but when they arrived that afternoon, the courtroom was packed. Wellborn sported a droopy mustache, his brown hair hanging to his shoulders, his blue eyes brimming. His sister, mother, and father were there. When Forrest heard the state ask the judge to set bail at $5 million, he covered his face with a towel and wept. Maurice Pierce wore jeans and a white T-shirt, his light brown hair gelled in spikes. A muscle in his jaw twitched as he listened to the proceedings, and his bright eyes sometimes closed momentarily. Otherwise, he let nothing show. Described as a diminutive woman whose reconnaissance eyes can lock into a target and search the soul, no-nonsense judge Jean Muirer altered the bail prices, $1.5 million for Pierce, $1 million for Wellborn. When transferred from the juvenile detention center to jail, each covered his head. After making dark remarks about suicide, Wellborn was put on immediate fire watch. To be on the safe side, Muirer also ordered psychiatric examinations for both. Barbara Sarasi, now Barbara Ayers Wilson, attended the hearing with her new husband, Manly Wilson. So did Pam and Bob Ayers. Having sold her house and moved to Oregon, Maria Thomas didn't make it back to Austin in time, but Eliza's father was there. In a statement to Aaron Moriarty, Pam Ayers expressed her surprise and radiant pleasure at this development. "The last thing on earth we were expecting." Bob Ayers said he hoped they had the right guys. Barbara Ayers Wilson dreaded revisiting September 6, 1991, and discovering exactly how horrible the girls' ordeal had been. The questions she'd been asking herself, were they afraid? Did they know they were going to die? Were Jennifer and Sarah close to each other when they were killed? Would now be answered, and she wondered if she was ready. So did the other parents. The front page of the October 7th Statesman was top to bottom yogurt shop. One story featured profiles of the four unremarkable young men who'd been arrested. and people who'd known them in high school expressed shock. In newspaper and television reports, all four were characterized as dropouts and their lives chronicled from childhood through broken families, failed classes, minor crimes, marriages, low-paying jobs. Yearbook photos accompanied the stories. Austinites read the details and studied the faces, then read the stories again. A former McCallum student, a young woman who gave her name as Janet, said the boys did do a lot of roaming and hanging out back then, but were never violent. Mike was the clown, the cut-up, always trying to make people laugh. Rob was an oddball who insisted on speaking his mind. Maurice had the car. Forrest was the quiet one. A week after the arrests, 22-year-old Amanda Statham would show up at the APD headquarters to inform Homicide that back in 1991 or 92, her friend Mike Scott had not only told her he'd committed the murders, but also showed her, her sister Sarah Adair, and her mom the gun he'd used. Although Mike was the sweetest guy she knew, he'd said they'd shot the girls and chopped off their heads and feet and left them on the counter. Neither she nor her sister had gone to the police back then, because their mother had told them not to, but now that Mike was under arrest. When Maggie Halliday, the former Pib, heard the news, she walked off her waitressing job and didn't go back. You mean the guy who'd kept her from slashing her wrists in the backyard of that house on Woodrow, when they'd all hung out back then? That Mike? Although the state of West Virginia had never granted a defendant's case against extradition except on grounds of mistaken identity, David Bungard fought against sending Springsteen to Texas, arguing that because West Virginia wasn't a death penalty state, the harshest penalty he should have to face was life without possibility of parole. But the Kanawha County prosecuting attorney had other ideas. If I can't kill them here, he joked, maybe I can help kill them in Texas. After a couple days' consideration, Circuit Court Judge Charles King ruled against Springsteen, and on November 18th, handcuffed, shackled, still dressed in his own clothes, he was flown by chartered jet to Austin, along with an APD officer, a Travis County ADA, and, of course, Chuck Meyer. All four boys were home again, and nobody but nobody was not noticing. Among those paying attention was Will Sheff, lead singer of an Austin rock band called Ockerville River. Sheff had a day job back then, doing clerical work. Hearing about the arrests, somebody had switched on an office television set. The people at work, he recalled, were watching the suspects of the yogurt shop murders, and they were just straining to see the evil in their faces. But evil don't look like anything. A year or so later, Sheff wrote Westfall, a mandolin-driven song about a boy who murdered a girl, which became known for its refrain, evil don't look like anything. Evil don't look like anything. Evil don't look like anything. It became Ockerville's most popular tune. In a different context, W.H. Auden said something similar. Evil is unspectacular and always human, and shares our bed and eats at our own table. Part 3. The Courts. Law, Science, Blunders, and Luck. Certification. Once Judge Muirer had read the Pierce and Wellborn affidavits, she picked up her phone. I didn't live in Texas in 1991, says criminal defense attorney Guillermo Gonzalez. I knew nothing about the yogurt shop murders. Without providing a reason, the judge told Gonzalez she needed him. And when he said he already had too many commitments, all she said was, be in my chambers this afternoon at 3. And that, he shrugs, was that. In the landmark unanimous 1963 decision, Gideon v. Wainwright, the Supreme Court ruled that state courts were required under the 14th Amendment to provide counsel in criminal cases for defendants who couldn't afford their own attorneys. But the implementation of this ruling was left to the states. In Texas, some counties employ public defenders, while most, including Travis, use attorneys chosen by the judge and paid, if modestly, by the county. In splashy cases, judges often appoint hotshot lawyers because of the inevitable press coverage and notoriety, but it's an iffy deal for popular attorneys. For a capital case, which can take years, in Travis County, the maximum pay for a lead defense attorney is $50,000. If you want to know the value Travis County places on a life, one anti-death penalty lawyer says, it's 50 grand. When Gonzalez and another defense attorney, Robert Eisenhower Ramirez, arrived in Muir's office, she held out two affidavits, one in each hand. Choose, she said. Gonzalez got Pierce, and Eisenhower Ramirez landed Wellborn. For the prosecution, Yogurt Shop belonged unreservedly to Ronnie Earle's favorite death penalty prosecutor, ADA Robert Smith, but he was busily involved with another capital case, and therefore his colleague, Howard Buddy Meyer, would work the juvenile courtroom. Within days of the appointments, Muir granted the attorney's request for a bail reduction hearing, at which Ron Lara argued against lowering the amount because the defendants were flight risks. In rebuttal, Wellborn's mother described her son's attachment to home and his job, his plan to buy a house for himself and his child, and his family's desire to raise the $1 million to bond him out. Kimberly Pierce then spoke of Maurice's strong family ties and pointed out that even after the police warned him he would be arrested, he stayed put. Innocent people don't run, she insisted. In closing, defense attorneys cited two other capital cases with bail set at $250,000. After a brief break, the judge agreed to reduce Pierce's bond to $750,000 and Wellborn's to $375,000. The cert hearing itself would begin within 30 to 60 days and would last between 10 days and 3 weeks. Sessions would not be held on the anniversary of the murders or the day after. In a bold move, Muir ordered the state to make available to both defense teams the 33 boxes of evidentiary material the APD had gathered over the past 8 years, a decision the DA's office ardently opposed. Prosecutors everywhere fight like crazy to hold on to whatever they can, dishing out to the defense only what they must, but they can't keep everything. The Supreme Court's 1963 Brady v. Maryland decision ruled that to satisfy the 14th Amendment due process mandate, the state was required to hand over to the defense any evidence that might prove exculpatory to its client. And a year later, in 2000, federal courts authorized a pretrial period of what's called discovery, in which prosecution and defense exchange raw evidence, including witness lists, crime scene evidence, autopsies, DNA, and ballistics reports. Once the judge banged her gavel, bailiffs escorted Pierce and Wellborn back to jail. 5 weeks later, Judge Muir called the cert hearing to order and stated its purpose: to decide if she should waive her jurisdiction and allow the case to be reassigned to the adult system for trial. Since both defendants were minors at the time of the murders and hadn't been indicted by the time they turned 18, Texas law limited her to two options: certify them as adults or set them free. This was not a trial. Muir's job was to respond to a single question: is it more likely than not that the young men committed the crime they were accused of? Buddy Meyer opened the state's case, citing the confessions by Michael Scott and Robert Springsteen, in which Pierce and Wellborn had been named as co-conspirators. The families of the girls sat side by side across the front row on the prosecution side, often holding hands, sometimes linking arms. 48 Hours had sent a cameraman and reporter. During a break, Bob Ayers told the press he didn't think victims' families should have to go through a certification hearing at all. "If you're grown up enough to pull the trigger," he said, "you're grown up enough to stand trial." The Ayerses liked to dress in costume, Bob in cowboy gear, complete with aviator sunglasses, large hat, tight jeans, boots, wide western belt, and pearl snap shirt. Pam often went western as well, but for opening day she'd chosen a cropped, wide-shouldered red jacket with braided gold frogs across the front that wrapped around shiny brass buttons, drum major style. Now that arrests had been made, the Ayerses were moving closer to Austin from their place near Blanco. The trials would be lengthy, and they intended to miss nothing. Barbara Ayers Wilson looked snazzy as ever, meticulously coiffed and made up. She says she's a little embarrassed about her behavior back then, dressing for the camera and rehearsing sound bites before leaving the house. But the girls needed a spokesperson, and if she was going to take on that responsibility, she wanted to be ready. Maria Thomas's wildly shorn hair looked barely combed, and behind dark-rimmed granny glasses, her expression was clamped and tight, giving her a madwoman aspect, furious on the one hand, fragile and crumbling on the other. Eliza's little sister, Sonora, previously always in the background, had accompanied her from Oregon. On the opposite side of the aisle, the Wellborn and Pierce families sat apart. In their opening statements, Gonzalez and Eisenhower Ramirez accused the APD of conducting a witch hunt in pursuit of Mike Scott and Rob Springsteen, and then linking the statements they'd wrung from them to their clients. Aside from that, the state's case depended on testimony from undependable sources, with no forensic evidence. Eisenhower Ramirez said that, as a result of poor police work, sitting next to him was an innocent man who risked having his very life and liberty stolen away. The downside for the state was that in order to get what it wanted, it had to reveal a healthy chunk of its case to the defense, the families, the city, and the media. Pieces of the videotaped confessions would be shown to the public for the first time. Hold back information would become common knowledge. If the APD didn't, in fact, have the right guys, the prosecution was obviously cooked. Hoping to seal the fate of all four men, Detective Paul Johnson resubmitted Pierce's 22 to the ATF ballistics lab without telling the DA. As his first witness, Meyer called Manuel Fuentes to read Mike Scott's written statement, after which Gonzalez, on cross-examination, asked why the witness had failed to ask Scott about the discrepancies between this and his videotaped confession. He actually hadn't seen the tapes, Fuentes had to admit, and knew little about what the accused had said other than what Johnson and Latta had told him. Other witnesses for the prosecution, Merrill, Latta, Hardesty, Johnson, provided narration for the tapes, which a technician played in stop-and-start fashion. Between the clips, each one lasting 10 or 15 minutes, a cop would testify. Merrill, who sat in the box like a bull about to charge, all readiness and forward motion, his white shirt strained against his thick belly, proved to be a good witness. Calm, patient, he didn't fluster or turn snarky. If as tetchy as most cops, he knew how to hide it. When asked why Scott's first statements conflicted with ones he gave later, Merrill simply said the early ones weren't the truth, and that to get the real story, they'd had to prod him to dig deeper inside himself. For instance, Scott said he'd seen Robert Springsteen raping a girl in the ICBY office, though everybody knew firefighters had found the office locked and undisturbed, the keys in place, on the cash register. Leading Mike to the truth took time. But what he and the other cops were sure of was that both Scott and Springsteen knew what happened, knew they were there, knew what they'd done. They'd buried the memories, which sometimes happened. A suspect comes up with inaccuracies and maybe isn't exactly lying, but definitely isn't telling the truth. When Gonzalez asked if Maurice Pierce was the main target of their investigation, even though he'd confessed to nothing, Merrill simply said, "Correct." From the get-go? Yes. After watching the first run of video clips, Bob Ayers told a television reporter, "I thought I had prepared for the worst. I didn't come close." Barbara Ayers Wilson called the experience a kind of persecution. At the end of the first day, she thought, "My God, it's only day one and we're not even in trial yet." Ayers also spoke of the years they'd waited. "We've put this out of our minds for so long. Now we need to get through the certification and get some indictments. We're ready to go to trial." On cross, Eisenhower Ramirez grilled Hardesty for hours, ripping into the APD's willingness to accept only the admissions that fit its conjectures. Paul Johnson testified about reopening the Maurice Pierce tips file. When asked by the state about Maurice's 22, he neglected to mention the ballistics tests he'd just run, which had come back from the lab with the same findings, probably not the murder weapon. On December 1st, the state rested its case. Defense recalled Hardesty and then Merrill. During a long, sometimes tedious, direct examination, they dismantled the prosecutorial theory of the boys' Friday night rape and murder spree, capped off with a Saturday morning theft of a Pathfinder and a victory lap ride to San Antonio, producing evidence that the car had been stolen sometime after Town North Nissan closed at 8 o'clock on Saturday night, almost 24 hours after the murders. When faced with this mistake, the intransigent Hardesty refused to back down. In one significant moment, when the defense played undecipherable clips from the Springsteen video and Merrill started to read from the transcript they'd put together, Muir stopped him to say she was deeply concerned with having a transcript based on somebody typing out what they think they heard. She also scolded the state for continually withholding exculpatory material from the defense, violating rules of discovery. Her opinions on these matters varied considerably from District Court Judge Mike Lynch's. On December 8th, when the state was asked to present its closing argument, Buddy Meyer reminded the judge that evidence from the crime scene indicated that the gun found on Maurice Pierce at North Cross Mall was the .22 caliber weapon that had been used in the offenses. This, of course, had never been confirmed by any firearms analysis, and there had been quite a few. But even ADA Meyer hadn't been told about the most recent one. On December 9th, as the families of the murdered girls stood holding hands across the front row, Judge Muir announced that she had found probable cause to believe that Maurice Pierce and Forrest Wellborn had committed the offenses alleged by the state. She would therefore remand them to the adult system, where the charges against them, four counts of capital murder, would be sent to the grand jury for possible indictment. Because they were minors at the time of the crime, they would not be eligible for the death penalty. With a 10% deposit of the total bail amount, she would allow the defendants to be released into the custody of their families. Maurice Pierce's eyes rolled up. Wellborn hung his head and wept. Court was adjourned. "We've crossed one hurdle," said a beaming Pam Ayers. "Now we're getting ready to step over another one." Her husband, who alone among the victims' families occasionally entertained the possibility of doubt, said he just hoped the system worked. Sonora Thomas talked about the 8 years they'd waited. In her mind, she said it was almost like it hadn't happened. I mean, if there's no criminal, then there's no crime, right? Forrest Wellborn's mother said if this was all the evidence the APD had, she couldn't imagine her son would be convicted. The next day, Wellborn's aunt emptied out her pension fund to come up with the $37,500 required to bond him out. Escorted by his father and his sister, India, a tearful Forrest left the jail. It was hard for him, India told the press, being in there and being innocent. But she was glad he was certified as an adult, so he could now clear his name. Gonzalez, who, in his closing statement, said he had no doubt that Springsteen and Scott were guilty and had sought to help themselves by fingering his client as the ringleader, had an unpleasant task ahead. If Pierce was indicted along with the other two, he'd have to make some apologies to their attorneys for casting blame on their clients. The DA's office wasn't happy with Muir about the 10% allowance, and ADA Rosemary Lemberg said they preferred that both young men remain in jail. Judge Muir had the file boxes of evidence shipped from her jury room to Judge Lynch. Because his chambers were small and somewhat accessible, he then had the files sent to his court reporter Jim King's office, where 33 brown cardboard boxes marked YSM in black Sharpie were stacked against a wall. On November 24th, Rob Springsteen's appointed attorney, Berkeley Burke Bettis, had asked for an examining trial for his client on December 1st, but ADA Robert Smith quickly requested a 30-day postponement due to his schedule. In an examining trial, a jailed but unindicted suspect comes before a magistrate who, after hearing accusatory evidence, decides whether or not to release the suspect pending the grand jury's decision. Bettis's move was strategic. If his request was granted, the DA's office would be forced to reveal much more of its case than it wanted to. The county official compromised, setting the procedure for December 15th. In the meantime, Bettis told the press, Mr. Springsteen is not guilty, and you may quote me on that. The sooner we get this case into court and ready for trial, the better. On December 14th, remembering the 1966 Supreme Court decision in Sam Shepard v. Maxwell, which temporarily set aside Shepard's conviction for the murder of his wife because of the carnival atmosphere of the trial, Mike Lynch signed a gag order prohibiting comment on Yogurt Shop by anyone associated with the case or the trial. A few hours later, Ronnie Earle, flanked by the victims' families, announced the grand jury indictment of Robert Burns Springsteen IV for capital murder, thus jumping the examining trial by one day. 2 weeks later, the same grand jury indicted Michael James Scott and Maurice Earl Pierce on the same charge, but refused to indict Forrest Brooke Wellborn. Determined to reel in his youngest suspect, Earl received permission to extend the grand jury term by another 90 days, so it could reconsider this decision. In response, Robert Eisenhower Ramirez invited prosecutors to his office to question Wellborn. After 3 hours, they left, apparently having learned nothing useful. Aaron Moriarty was also given permission to interview Wellborn. Shackled, wearing a dark blue prison jumpsuit, his dark hair streaming around his face and reaching well below his shoulders, he looked straight into the camera and protested his innocence. He wasn't there, he said. He knew nothing about those murders. And as for his friends, I can't see them doing anything like that. When Mike Scott's family learned the identity of the attorney Lynch had appointed, they protested. So the judge came up with another name. And when that one didn't meet with their approval, yet another. In the end, the family put some money together and called a lawyer they'd heard about, Pedro Antonio Tony Diaz, from South Texas, who, having been suspended from the bar, was extremely available. The family couldn't pay much, but Diaz was known primarily as a civil rights litigator, and Yogurt Shop was his shot at big-time redemption and fame, so he quickly signed on. Separated in county jail, each living in holding tanks that housed 4 to 8 inmates, Springsteen, Pierce, and Scott made friends, ate bad food, shooed off rats. The DA's office had planted audio recording devices in case they said anything incriminating. Pierce, for instance, would stand in line many times a day to make phone calls home, all of which were duly taped. Meanwhile, Wellborn, now the father of 2 small children, went back to fixing cars. Awaiting the grand jury's decision, he got a tattoo, and then another. In the coming years, he would become a ready canvas for the skin artist's needle. Indicted first, Springsteen would be tried first, which makes sense. But the defense lawyers had other ideas. Garcia and Diaz think that because Scott's confession was problematic, Robert Smith thought Springsteen would be easier to prosecute and that once they'd gotten the verdict they were after, the next jury would be more likely to cave as well. Sawyer, on the other hand, thinks Smith knew from the beginning he'd offer a sweet deal to the first defendant to come to trial, and that Springsteen's lawyers were more likely than Scott's to convince him to take it. In any case, Garcia was surprised by the decision. Diaz was disappointed. Sawyer liked the idea, and Robert Smith isn't saying. Although the co-defendants would be tried separately, defense attorneys for the 3 young men began working together immediately, discussing expert witnesses and preparing to push for speedy trials. In late December, when Jim Sawyer asked to be on the Springsteen team, Burke Bettis welcomed the help. He knew Sawyer well, and he couldn't really afford to devote the kind of time a capital case demanded, especially this one. In addition, the Texas Criminal Code required that in a capital case, an indigent defendant should receive counsel from 2 attorneys. Lynch authorized the funds and approved the appointment. As for Tony Diaz, it didn't take him long to realize how unqualified he was to run a death sentence defense. So within a year, he would convince the Scott family to dig up enough money to hire Dexter Guilford, a respected criminal defense attorney, as co-counsel. Christmas came and went. The families of the murdered girls made plans, as did the arrested boys' families. None of them could have predicted how many tedious and painful months would pass before Judge Lynch gaveled the court to order in the first of many pre-trials. The Statesman and the Austin Chronicle often commented on the thinness of the state's case, the lack of evidence, the bungled investigation, while the general consensus among citizens remained constant. They confessed, so let's get on with it. As the 20th century came to an end and the world awaited apocalyptic technological snafus, Austin defense lawyers and prosecutors readied themselves for what was about to happen. And in the jury trials, 4 men will play leading roles: the judge, the lead defense attorneys, and the lead prosecutor. Many others participated, but these extravagantly dissimilar men worked the main controls, called the shots, and created the inevitable theater at the heart of every criminal trial, often as powerful an influence on a jury as the evidence itself. As Jim Sawyer once commented, "A trial is stagecraft, pure and simple." The Judge. During Scott, for the first time in his 9 years on the bench, Mike Lynch kept a journal. "I am sitting in court in the trial of State v. Michael Scott," he began, "a capital murder case where the state is seeking the death penalty. This makes the 5th death penalty case I've been involved in over the last 5 years. And he chronicled the prior 4, ending with Saldana, which had commenced 4 months after he was asked to sign arrest warrants for Pierce, Springsteen, and Scott. after detailing the crime in a few lines, calling it one of Austin's most infamous and heinous crimes, he mentioned the all-out press coverage.